This episode is presented by The Green Grape and the New York Women's Culinary Alliance.
Hey, Food Radio listeners. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie, and I'm really excited to share that we're launching a brand new show. Meat and Three is HRN's weekly food news roundup. Tune in for a deep dive and three tasty shorts every Friday evening. It's 15 minutes, so you can listen while you wait for your pizza. This week, the fight for universal free lunch in New York City public schools isn't over yet.
I'm overburdened. I'm overworked. I don't get staff when people are out.
Plus, Dana Cowan, former editor of Food & Wine magazine and host of HRN's Speaking Broadly, catches up with Valerie Lomas, the winner of the Great American Baking Show's Derailed Season 3. Discover how a Danish brewery is motivating people to get fit, and hear Allison Roman speak to the highs and lows of her cookie recipe going viral.
Every time I see anyone in a social setting, that's generally the first thing they ask me is, how are the cookies?
Be better informed and wildly inspired by the stories and people you hear on Meat and Three. Find us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
You heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style.
We're back. The Main Course OG. We were the first show. Thank you, Vitor. We were the first show ever to air on HRN. We were the first show to achieve 200 episodes in HRN, and we're back. We've added the word letters OG at the end of our name. I'm in studio with Elizabeth Greeley, our point guard.
Hi.
Thank you.
With Emily Pearson, our born and raised New York wit.
Good morning.
Mike Edison, a host of Arts and Seizures.
I put the OG in the OG. Yo.
We're engineered and curated by Vitor Hurt.
Hello.
And we're going to get started. So we're going to lay out the show agenda. We're going to do our weekly based, where Libby takes us through a quick summary of four topics, and we'll respond to them one at a time. Then we're going to go to break. Then we're going to words to marinate on. We're going to play a 1 minute audio piece and then react to it. Then the Maillard reaction. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Those are silent L's, where Libby asks the panel a question and we will answer it. And then we're going to welcome our guest for the last segment. And we actually don't know what these stories are or what the question is. So it'll be interesting. Let's get started.
Great. So for our weekly base, these are current topics that caught my eye, and I want to hear what everyone thinks about them. So each person has 60 seconds or less, and our first is from CTV News, and there is a debate in the food industry about what can be labeled as meat. Should steak or hamburger be labeled meat if it is plant-based? U.S. cattle industry players have tried to crack down on labeling. They want to reserve the term meat or beef for animal proteins only, and a large part of the concern is loss in market share. What do you think about this, Mike?
This is what I call vegan envy. All right, like I don't understand the concept of a tofurkey. I don't understand the concept of a tofu hot dog. If you want to eat a hot dog, eat a hot dog. I do not get why vegetarians and vegans want their plant-based food in the shape of meat. It makes no sense. I find it to be an extreme psychological deficiency. You know, I mean, why not make like a tofu pork chop? I see that next. Or, you know, why not a tofu dog or cat or something useful like a chair or an alarm clock? You see what I'm saying? It's absurd. It makes no sense to mold tofu into the shape of something else. Just have enough confidence with your own skin to be who you are. You want to eat vegan? Eat vegan. That's all. I feel like, you know, it's just like, wow, you get to eat a hot dog? I want to eat a hot dog. I want to say, join the club. Be part of the club. You know, you're welcome. You're invited. But you can't put on this mask and walk in the door like that. It doesn't work.
And I say, you know, you can't co-opt the nutrients that come from meat. So, you know, by trying to confuse the consumer, you don't get vitamin B12. You don't get those healthy animal fats. You don't get that same necessary energy from the proteins that you get in meat. And so Just you have to call it something different. It really confuses to use technically what is the enemy as the defining terminology to describe all your food seems absurd to me. Emily?
I think it's also just thinking about, you know, there is that concern of loss in market share and the idea that, you know, not every consumer is educated and not every consumer spends an hour and a half in the supermarket like I do. My husband yells at me that I've taken too long in aisle one. So I'm reading all the labels, whether I care about them or not, but I'm trying to identify what it is that I'm shopping for, but not everybody does. So they see meat and they grab it off the shelf.
What do you think, Libs?
Yeah, I think we need to really help customers not be confused and understand what they are buying. And if it's not meat, it should not be labeled as such. Mm-hmm. As Mike said, it's absurd. So on our next topic, it's from The Hill, and this is a hot topic going on right now, the Farm Bill. So the Protect Interstate Commerce Act, or the King Amendment, is a highly debated part of the Farm Bill. King's Amendment would force states to authorize the sale of any agricultural product not prohibited under federal law. And if any one state tolerates the production or manufacture of a particular agricultural product under the King Amendment, the other 49 states must do so as well. This eliminates states' historic powers to police within their borders. And basically, states with stricter laws now have to follow states with the most relaxed laws. So it is essentially a race to the bottom. This could mean wiping out states' laws aimed at protecting food safety, animal welfare, the environment, and more. And this is an amendment that is highly debated right now. They're trying to slip in.
Well, I would say, you know, first of all, California is always this is Patrick, always ahead of the game on all these things. I think California should be the standard, the highest standards for things, not Louisiana, which might have like the lowest standards of things. Heritage Foods, this company I started, which is like the largest retailer of heritage breed meats in the country, has always been immune from the commodity world, the ins and outs of the lowest common denominator. And I like that. We're off the grid. And I encourage people to be off the grid too. Buy from farmers markets, especially when it comes to meats. You know, be off the grid because you're untouchable. You don't go through the fluctuations of price. You don't go through fluctuations of quality. You're always getting the best. But you have to live off the grid because really, I don't trust the politicians with food. And I certainly don't trust the boards of major corporations with food. I mean, this is kind of a tough rule to follow, but you should never eat food from publicly traded companies.
Yeah, what Patrick said exactly. It's a good rule. You should never buy food from a company that's publicly traded because at the bottom line is what they're looking at. It's certainly not your health. The problem with this bill, this is sort of like kind of ass backwards the way state rights usually work as it's pushed forward by right-wing politicians because state rights are traditionally used to hold up things like abortion laws and to be against LGBT rights under some, you know, like Jim Crow was held up under states' rights laws. But here they're saying, okay, we're going to get rid of the states' rights laws to mandate, you know, these awful, generally non-progressive things to bring it, you know, to the bottom so that if it's okay to put pig poop in the river in Louisiana, then it's okay to do so in California. And this is where big agriculture wins and people lose. You know, I mean, frankly, you know, it's nuts. But it's weird that it's topsy-turvy because state rights when it suits us, you know, but we're going to write a federal law, you know, when it doesn't. I mean, they'll fight to the death over marijuana, of course, until they see the tax money coming in. But they'll fight that, you know, you have to go to an appropriate gender bathroom in Kentucky, but it's okay to dump, you know, pig shit in the river.
I think it's also a shame just because there are smaller, you know, kind of local farms. You can go to the farmer's market, you can know your farmer, and they get to meet the customer. But some of these groups are trying to create slightly larger brands for themselves. You know, at Heritage Foods, we work with some charcuterie makers that are trying to become, you know, USDA. They want to be able to cross state lines with their products and be considered on a larger playing field. But this is kind of saying, like, you know, maybe you should just stay small scale. Mm-hmm. So I think it's tricky.
What do you think, Libs? Race to the bottom.
I think the Farm Bill is very complicated. There's a lot of different elements being debated, and it's important to stay on top of it. And this King Amendment is definitely something they tried to get in 2014. They're trying to get it in again, and we need to be aware of it and make sure it does not pass. It's going backwards, and we really need stricter laws, especially to support animal welfare and the environment. And on that same lines, we have GMO labeling, and this is from Modern Farmer. It was a great headline that caught my eye. The USDA's proposal for GMO food labels is here and it's wacky. That was the headline. After a drawn-out debate, President Obama in 2016 signed into law a bill requiring genetically modified foods to have labels. The USDA released the labels this week, and they are green smiley faces inside suns with the term bioengineered underneath. How do we feel about this? Is this the label that we've been fighting for?
You want to go first?
Yeah, you know, this reminds me of like when they used to put like pictures of Snoopy and Mickey Mouse on LSD. to make this extremely dangerous thing seem very friendly. You know, there's a bar in the East Village. It's called KGB. It's a very famous bar, very famous literary site. A friend of mine refuses to go in there. He says, "Look, my family's from Eastern Europe. Would you go to a bar called like SS or KKK?" And to me, this is like mislabeling of the same kind of level. It's like really trying to hoodwink in you with a smile face, and you have no idea what it means. You're going down into like a, you know, that it's like the first step on that train into the haunted house at Coney Island, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's a smile face, but that's not the way it ends up. Yeah. It never does. This story never ends well. This is a bad idea.
Mike, I read that they are requesting comments, and you can comment publicly. I think I saw from like July 3rd to July 29th, so I think you should start now.
I should also say that I tried some of the Snoopy LSD with good results, so maybe Obama's on the right path.
So GMO labeling, that's the best headline since the Post ran this article, Wacko Jacko Backo on Tracko. That was a headline, if you can believe that, from the
that was
like,
my favorite. It's not even English.
GMO labeling, that logo shouldn't be a sun, it should be like some corporate factory. But GMO labeling, I always remember what Carlo Petrini, who I worked with for a year and a half in the same office, basically, in Slow Food, he always said to me, the GMO's argument when they first started and were trying to gain converts is that it was a temporary solution before going back to seeds, regular seeds that you don't have to go back to your corporate masters to buy, seeds that aren't dead-end seeds, seeds that aren't concocted in factories, but seeds that have 5,000 years of agricultural tradition behind them. It was temporary, especially in places like Africa. The goal was never to raise hybrid seeds. It was always to raise things that naturally grew there. And what we've realized is that was all BS. There's nothing temporary about it. I mean, they're just trying to substitute for what regular agriculture is. So absolutely it should be labeled, because it shouldn't even have been a long-term solution in the first place.
But they're not even labeled saying GMO. Those letters are nowhere on there. It says bioengineered.
With a sunny yeah. And a sunny face.
Exactly. I think this just causes more confusion in labeling, which the whole point in labeling it is to make it clear on what the customer is buying, what's inside it, and how it was made. Any other thoughts on this, Emily?
No, I spend too much time in the supermarket aisle as it is. So,
but that being said, you know, Bill Gates, and they've invested billions of dollars in GMO. So, you know, it's not a clean cut GMO bad, regular farm good. It's much more complicated.
I agree with that. I mean, there's GMO and then there's GMO. I mean, there's the real Frankenfood, and there's the stuff like Monsanto trying to control the life on the planet. And then from my understanding of it, there are some things that were meant to create faster growing crops to feed, you know, impoverished nations. And then the other thing, like I said, is Frankenfood and just trying to save money with unknown results, with unknown health results for humans. So just something that has been engineered doesn't necessarily make it bad, but you don't know. And that's the problem. No matter how much time you spend in aisle one, you will never know.
Exactly. Another article from Modern Farmer was, after 4 years, a lawsuit targeting anaerobic lagoons, literally huge pits of hog feces, came to a decision. The 10 plaintiffs involved said that the lagoons negatively impacted their quality of life in North Carolina thanks to putrid odors, buzzards, and swarms of insects. The lawsuit was against Kinlaw Farms, who is beholden to Smithfield Foods. The plaintiffs were awarded over $50 million. And although lawmakers with financial ties to the hog industry have attempted to put a hard cap on the amount of money a plaintiff can receive in this kind of lawsuit, the cap they want is $225,000, much less than what they are entitled to. But this still was a huge win in a lawsuit that's been going on, like I said, over 4 years.
So if anyone wants a visual of this, pig lagoons are actually shown in the new film that's coming out in June. It's premiering in New York, Eating Animals. It's based on the book by Jonathan Safran Foer, and it's produced and narrated by Natalie Portman. Our very own Frank Reese, our longtime poultry farmer and friend, is featured in the film, and it's... it's worth seeing. It's going to be premiering in throughout the country this June. But check it out, because there are visuals of what these pig lagoons look like and what Big Ag is doing.
The Water Keepers Alliance has done a lot. Kennedy upstate the Water Keepers Alliance, and they would fly planes over to show Americans what's really happening there. I mean, I wrote a book which no one read called The Carnivore's Manifesto. And I actually co-wrote it with Mike Edison. I always like to say Mike was the most important 1% of any book. No, he was a lot more than that. But anyway, one of the chapters was called Share the Shit. And basically, you can't raise that many animals in that small a space. Meat has to cost more. And you have to raise smaller amounts in more places, and that's going to add to cost, because you then have to distribute them and get them to the slaughterhouse and transport them more. It's not quite as efficient, but neither are pig lagoons.
Well, I've been pretty unequivocal on this. I think anybody who puts poison in a river should go to jail forever and ever and ever and ever. I mean, it's crazy to put... If you've ever been there, if you've seen those pictures, it's just giant reservoirs of pig effluence. Mm-hmm. And it stinks, and it's dangerous, and it's unhealthy.
It would always happen. It's just you can't put that many pigs in one little terroir. You know, that's the problem.
It's absolutely insanity. But it's like, it's talking about poisoning, the well. Talking about, spoiling the nest. I mean, if I came over to your house and pooped in your living room, you would call the police. You would put me in jail or the mental hospital.
I didn't do it. Last time you did it.
At least. And I see this as being no different. The people who poison the planet, it's absolutely the very definition of insane behavior.
Yeah, it's a side effect of factory farming. And we see in that video, Emily was talking about rivers that were once, thriving with fish are now empty and poisoned. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a huge, huge issue that needs to be addressed.
So let's go to break, and we'll come back and listen to a 1 minute farmer audio and react to that.
This episode is presented by The Green Grape, a family of three businesses on Fulton Street committed to supporting small-scale farms, celebrating seasonality, and delighting their customers. Order local pasture-raised meats and cheeses to pair with their selection of fine wines and spirits, and they'll deliver to your door at no extra charge. From great local gifts to providing all you need for a delicious meal, The Green Grape offers truly special and hard-to-find products created by New York's community of local makers. Support independent grocers and visit their website to learn more. Greengrape.com. That's GREENE grape.com. This episode is also presented by the New York Women's Culinary Alliance, a vibrant and supportive community of professional women who work in all areas of food, beverage, and hospitality, and come together to network, learn, and share their passion. Membership is only open once a year, every spring, so now is the time to join. The deadline is Wednesday, May 23rd. Visit nywca.org for more details.
Well, we're back. Thank you, Vitor, for bringing us back. So now this is our second segment, and it is called Words to Marinate On. All right, Vitor, will you play this 1 minute video from farmer David Newman, and we will react to it.
Here's the thing, that's 250,000 loins, right?
Well, I mean, holy shit, statistics will work on your side. At least half of 1% are going to be good, right? It's just going to be that odd pig that marbled really well and a really dark color. When you have
are there good genetics piping through their system at all, or it's just luck?
Not from equality. No. Not from equality.
Their entire genetic line is compromised.
Built on efficiency.
But occasionally one, almost through a mutation, will come out tasting delicious.
Yeah, but it's not a mutation. It will just taste delicious because it's... And maybe it was just that one little fat kid, who liked to sit at the... he never would get away from the snack bar, right? I mean, he just sat there and ate and ate and... Excuse me. I'm a scientist, right? So here's the thing. 95% confidence interval, right? That's what they teach you in science. P.05, right? So if you are... The point is, there's always a one-off chance that anything can be odd. You're not going to tell anyone that... you know,
100% of the time.
Yeah, just, yeah. I mean, it's just going to absolutely crush it.
Is 8 out of 10 the number you pick because you think that's right?
Or you're being overly conservative?
What is it really?
All right, I'll tell you what I think it is. I mean, I think I'm being overly conservative when I say that number.
All right. Well, that was, you know, not the best audio, but that was David Newman. He's a Berkshire farmer. He also sits on the National Pork Board. And what kind of struck me as interesting is that occasionally you will get a supermarket pork chop that tastes as good as an Iberico Bellotta acorn-fed pork chop. And that's just because it might have been the one at the trough all the time, or it might have not. He didn't call it a mutation, but... what strikes me about that quote is this idea that not all big farms are necessarily bad and not all small farms are necessarily good. And even though mutation is not the right word, like occasionally, nothing's ever 100%. And I'm sure David, 2 out of his 10 pigs will turn out not to have the best pork chops. And occasionally we get complaints and we're like, really? We've never heard that before from David's pig. And yet it could happen. So sometimes stuff just happens.
But what's interesting is we know our farmer. So then we pick up the phone and we call David and we're like, hey, what happened? And he's like, well, I know this one particular pig. He was a little lazier than the other ones. But I think when you're calling your factory farmer, which you don't get to do anyway, you know, it's just, it was luck of the draw that it was a good one. But
well, I think you're talking about biology, first of all. And second of all, you're talking about traditional farming. So, of course, there's going to be some inconsistency mm-hmm. versus the other system, which is based on inconsistency. You know what it reminds me of, Patrick, is the guy we're talking about today, the Japanese baseball player for the Dodgers.
Otani.
Right, the pitcher.
The
right,
Angels.
Right, the pitcher who's great at the plate. It's an anomaly. We don't see that very often. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean there's going to be a new super race of pitchers, you know, who can hit the ball, mm-hmm. you know, a la Babe Ruth. This is just the one guy that slipped through a system that is designed for specialty.
Yeah. It's just funny. I imagine that taste test where the...
taste test in the Japanese guy.
No. That we don't need people. But the, you know, where the commodity company is like, please let this be one of the 10, 1 in 10. And the Newman being like, please don't let this be my 1 in 10. You know, so I would rather bank on 80, 90% than on 10 to 20%.
That's what I was going to say. Okay. The odds are in David's favor, for sure.
For sure. So, well, let's go to our next segment. By the way, thanks for Pat. For pulling that clip together, and thanks to David for being the most interesting pig farmer ever born. He's a mutation.
And apologies from Emily and Patrick for interrupting all of that. David's brilliant thoughts while we were interviewing him.
So tell us about this next segment. We have a new segment. It's called the
Mylard Reaction.
Vitor, there we go.
Perfect. And this is when I come up with a question and give it to our guests and get to see what they think about it. So the one for today, what is the biggest lie in the food industry right now?
Ooh, what is the biggest food lie in the industry now?
I think it has something to do with Mr. Softy.
Mr. Softy.
Because I see a lot of fake Mr. Softies rolling around. In fact, I saw a fake Mr. Softy get into a fist fight with the guy who I thought was the real Mr. Softy on my street in Brooklyn last year. So I'm very concerned about you know, false flag attacks on the soft serve ice cream front.
Yes, Mike is 10 pounds overweight. Though the wow, that was an interesting one. I would say the biggest lie to me is that fast food is cheap. Meat can't be cheap meat. To say that meat is cheap and you see it for $1.99 a pound, that's not the real cost. I think that's the biggest lie, is that fast food is cheap. It's the, you know, and by the way, arguing for cheap meat is classist at best and racist at worst. No poor person should ever be told to eat the kind of meats that are coming out of the factory farm system. We basically argue for vegetarianism if it's not from farmer market type quality things, places. So,
Well, something we continue to talk about at Heritage Foods and is the just eating, part. Yeah, is just eating smaller portions. You know, still have the best quality and buy the best that you can get your hands on. You know, just eat less of it. You don't need a 20-ounce steak. You can have a 4 to 6 ounce piece and do just as well for your body and for your wallet.
Or look at Italy, right? Pasta, you used 1 ounce of ground pork. That whole dish costs you $3.
Yeah, for me, the biggest lie is people in the food industry knowingly labeling incorrectly to get consumers to buy, saying it's pasture raised when maybe they have a few, they can go outside on pasture for a little bit. They can move maybe a few more steps. They're not in crates, but making, you know, consumers believe that they're buying something where the animals are treated better and they're really not.
So yours was labeling, yours was portion size, mine was that meat is cheap, Mike's was Mr. Softy.
Yeah.
Got it.
Mike's fighting for the ice cream industry.
I'm fighting for Mr. Softy.
All right. Well, we do have our special guest in house. It's our one guest of the show. It's always our last segment on the Main Course OG. You are listening to the Main Course OG broadcasting live at Heritage Radio Network. We always forget to say that. So before introducing you, Joanne Fleming, forensic accountant, do you have an answer to the Maillard question? What's the biggest lie in the food industry right now?
Oh, God, put me on the spot. No, I'm going to pass on that. I have other better ideas.
Okay, so welcome our guest, Heritage Radio Network board member, Joanne Fleming.
Thank you.
Former host of Flash Talks Cash. And I was not exaggerating. She's a forensic CPA accountant. That's the highest level of accountant in the world. So it is an honor to have you. It is an honor to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So I have a question. I'll read the first one. What are the top financial mistakes made by small family businesses, especially food businesses?
Okay. Well, I've worked with a lot of small businesses in my years, and the food business is not unique as far as small businesses go. I mean, it has its own things, especially restaurants. That's a little unique as opposed to ordinary, regular businesses. But anyway, the questions that constantly come up with new businesses when they're struggling and they made some sort of problems along the way is they're underfunded. They don't have enough money to run their new business for a year or two or three. They run into all sorts of problems like credit card debt, which is very difficult to get out of when you're launching a new business. New business could take 2 to 3 years to take off. You have credit card debt. You're struggling for 5 to 6 years if you can get out from under. Lots of new companies go out and crowdsource funds, and sometimes that works. It sounds more glamorous than it is. It's often not enough to actually get the business going. So they really, really struggle with not having enough money to run the operation. To open up a new business takes lots of money, and we all have heard those horror stories about restaurants taking millions of dollars and other businesses needing lots of money to get started. But then after they get open their doors, they need money to run their business, pay their salaries, and pay rent and pay for insurance. And these things bury new businesses all the time. So that's the number one problem that I see. Another one that I often see is the person or people opening this new business are really good at what they do. They could be great chefs. They could be great computer people, software writers. Doesn't make them good business people. You have to have a set of skills to run a business. Just because you cook good food doesn't mean you can manage people, manage inventory, figure out pricing, when to take risks, when to pull back. Those are often a big problem for new business people. And lots of new businesses fail because they don't know enough about business. Some of them bury their heads in the sand and they don't want to know about business. They don't want to deal with that part of the business. Well, you're in business, you know, so you got to deal with the business part of the business.
That makes sense. Know your strengths, but know your weaknesses and find people who have that as strengths.
Right. And listen to them. You can find them, but you got to listen to them.
Great. So how will the new tax laws affect food businesses and family farms?
Ugh. Well, let me start with, I hate the new tax law and I hate the whole regime up there, you know, that whole thing. So I'll start with that. The new tax law affecting small businesses, family businesses, food businesses is pretty much, actually, it doesn't hurt businesses as badly as it hurts individuals. So they lowered the corporate tax brackets, which sounds very, very good. However, first of all, you have to be a C corporation, which most small businesses are not. They're considered pass-throughs like LLCs or S corporations. But if you're a corporation, your tax brackets got lowered. But your tax brackets got lowered if you start to show profits. Your tax bracket starts to get lowered if you're showing profits of over $50,000. Most small businesses don't show profits of $50,000. If you're Apple, you probably have billions of dollars of profit. But when you're, you know, a small company and you have profits of $50,000 or more, you start to think about tax strategies, and it's avoiding the corporate taxes. So dropping the bracket down to 21%, it's not going to help most small businesses. There's a new deduction for pass-throughs, which I explained to you just a few minutes ago, are LLCs and S-corporations. That's going to reduce your tax brackets. That's going to be a help. There are some limits, but for the most part, that's going to be a bonus for small businesses. So I look forward to that. Most of my small businesses will benefit by that tax credit or tax deduction.
So you look forward to a tax.
I look forward to the reduction in the tax. It's called a tax deduction. Yeah, that's a good thing. I like tax deductions. I like tax credits. Some of the other things that are happening is, you know, lots of businesses take their clients or their customers out and sit in the front row of the Brooklyn Nets or at Barclays Center or you know, treat a weekend or suite in the Yankees, you know, up in the Bronx. Well, all that entertainment expense is now no longer deductible. So how is that going to impact some businesses? Well, they're still probably going to take them out, and it's not deductible legally.
Is that only if you sit in the first row?
I think if you go to the circus and you're up in the balcony, it's still got that same problem. So.
Actually, that is not fair because for a food business like ours, that's not entertainment. That's research to go to the restaurants.
No,
that's
accounts. No, restaurant deductions are still 50%.
Oh, it's truly like sports.
Just entertainment. Things that.
What if you're a scout?
That's research. That's a different industry. But we're talking about a small business, mostly in the food industry.
Okay,
right.
Got it.
Right. So, you know, that entertainment is not going to be a big plus. And I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Finish.
And I got one more thing. This is going to be a problem for a lot of small businesses. Interest expense is not going to be deductible the way it has been. There's going to be limits on it. And lots of small companies have lots of interest through loans and credit cards. So we're going to have to now eat some of it, carry it forward, not deduct it. And, you know, the goal is to not have so much interest. Because as I said earlier on, a big problem is people who have too much interest or credit card debt have a hard time running their business successfully.
Well, thank you so much for that, Joanne. One last question. As a former host of Heritage on Heritage Radio, yes. What most excites you about Heritage Radio, and what is the biggest change you have seen since you became a founding board member back in 2010?
Well, this is really grown really nicely. We've all grown. We came here, it was really pirate radio. We had very little as far as experience from the head, the chief cook and bottle washer.
Who are you pointing to,
and
Libby?
And then the engineer and the hosts and the show. It was a lot of fun. It was learning on the seat of our pants, and it is now a groomed better. I mean, I think it is. And it looks fancier, and I think we're all doing a better job, and the executive director and the president of the board are really top shelf.
And the engineer, the sound effects guy. Well, that was a great first show back, Main Course OG. Our goal has always been to be one of the top 35 shows on the network, the Main Course. So we hope we've achieved that. And thanks for listening. And we will be back next week with these same segments. Thanks to Vitor. Thanks to Elizabeth Greeley, Emily Pearson, Mike Edison, Joanne Fleming. And stay tuned for Tech Bites in 15 minutes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Like the